This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Empress of a Thousand Skies by Rhoda Baeza. Read for you by Rebecca Soler. Part 1. The Betrayed. After a series of tragedies befell them, it was believed that the Ta'an family was cursed. This made the sole survivor of that legacy, the young Princess Rhiannon, even more precious in the eyes of the public. When a reporter dubbed her the Rose of the Galaxy, the moniker stuck. She was seen as something delicate, a thing to be preserved and protected until she came of age to rule. But Rhiannon had other plans. Excerpt from The Iron Star, A History of the Ta'an Dynasty. Chapter 1. Rhiannon. Rhi tore a path through the bustling marketplace, kicking up dust that fell slowly in Nau Fruma's low gravity. The foreign tourists coughed and complained as she passed, but Rhi ignored them, scanning the fairgrounds for Julian as she clutched his miniature telescope to her chest. She wasn't accustomed to being in a crowd. So much of her life had been spent looking down at one from a balcony, urged to wave and smile and look as ladylike as possible. But now, among the people, there was a jostle and roughness to it that Rhi found thrilling. It was the golden hour, and the sun dipped just below the horizon. Risking a quick glance behind her, Rhi spotted one of the Ta'an plowing through the ebb and flow of bodies, headed in her direction. His khaki-fitted uniform and polished badges stood out amid the sea of vibrant linen robes. His skin was ashen and pale, unlike the men who'd grown up on this desert moon and knew the heat of the sun by its true distance, not through the refracted beams and domed cities on Kalu. From here, she could see that his hand hovered above the stunner strapped to his belt. The Ta'an were the royal guard, her royal guards technically, but they felt like a relic of her father's era, wholly separate from the life she'd led here on Nau Fruma. They were an elite group of fighters plucked from the ranks of Uniforce soldiers and trained in personal security. This guard was one of many men sent to find her so she could return home to Kalu, to the planet of her birth. Rhi had been 6 when she left, just after her entire family had died in a crash. An accident, the authorities called it. A tragedy Rhi had supposedly been lucky to avoid. But she knew better. There were 2 things for certain: that her family had been murdered, and that she was supposed to have died at their side. A homemade firework screeched into the darkening sky, its high-pitched fury petering out into a low whistle. It exploded in the distance. She wondered if her family's ending had been that instantaneous and merciful. Rhi slipped the telescope in her pocket and pulled her hood lower to hide her mismatched eyes, one brown and one hazel. She tucked back her jet-black braid and cut left between 2 rows of tents, squeezing past 2 laughing men. Dodging a tall woman carrying a cage, she flinched when the white bird inside flapped its wings, then felt silly.
"Stay at the ready," Varen had always said as he'd held up 2 calloused hands for her to box and kick.
She'd cycle through combos until all she could hear was her heartbeat drumming in her ears. In the dojo, she wasn't a girl or a princess. She was simply a series of intentions. Dodge. Strike. Block. Kill. Kill. Now her stomach felt twisted, like the cactus trunks she and Julian would find when they snuck past the palace walls. The smell of smoke and charred meat from a nearby market stall nearly made her gag. A Derkatsian girl with yellow eyes sat perched on a stool, fanning herself with one hand and holding out a root vegetable with the other.
"Grown from real soil," she called to those who passed.
Everyone was out, travelers and dealers from the fringes of the universe,
local families, wealthy tourists. Tonight marked the eve of the Camriol meteor shower, which came every 149 years. "Once in a lifetime," the Hollows had said, "never to be seen again." Which was precisely why the Crown Regent had arranged this night for Rhiannon to travel back to the capital of Cebu. The beloved Rose of the Galaxy, returning to Kalu in a shower of stars. It was all image and spin, a big fat lie wrapped up in a pretty bow. There was no love lost between Rhi and the Regent Siotra, who'd taken control of the throne until Rhi came of age. He'd been her father's childhood friend, and a decorated war hero, before he'd entered politics to become one of the Emperor's closest advisors. Until Regent Siotra had betrayed her family. The Ta'an was an old bloodline. The throne had been in her family for 12 generations, and you could trace the Ta'an back nearly 3 centuries. They were among the first settlers in the East. The dark soil of Kalu was part of Rhi's skin. The ocean in her veins, the roots of the trees her own. She'd spent weeks replaying her memories of her childhood in the capital, so that when she finally returned, it would feel like home. Siotra had rallied the support to send Rhi to Nau Fruma in the first place. "For her safety," he'd claimed. And while it was a politically neutral moon, according to the Ernu Treaty, it also kept Rhi as far as possible from her true birthright, the throne. It was a power move to remain crown regent and block her ascension to power. Siotra was worried. As he should be. Rhi would see to it that he pay for what he'd done to her family. She'd trained for years for the very moment when she would end his reign and his life. She only wished she could kill him more than once. "Honor, bravery, loyalty," she whispered. Rhi looked back toward the palace, where she had spent most of her childhood. It was high up on the hill, just a short distance from the town, though it felt like a world away. A prison meant to keep her from the real world and her destiny. It had once been the second home of her family. To the east of it, she could just make out the throat of an old volcano, isolated, rising up from the flat desert plains around it. Crown's Rock. Tai Rayana, Rhi's longtime governess, had remarked on how fitting it was for Rhi to be so close to a crown.
"Iwish Nick," boomed a deep voice, and she was nearly knocked off her feet by a madrasal. Its tentacle left a sticky residue on her clothing.
Looking over her shoulder, she could only make out antennae protruding from a high-collared outfit, its clothes soaked with a slime-like secretion. As their temperatures ran high, madrasals were known to sweat profusely. She hurried on. A message came through her cube just as she reached the square, and Tai Rayana's call sign flashed across her vision. Rhi's blood leapt. The Tai was a sect of teachers and caretakers, and Simone Rayana was a Tai of the highest order. She served the royal family and had been Rhi's exclusive governess ever since her family died. Rhi wasn't used to ignoring her calls, but she wasn't used to running off in the first place. Rhi knew what she had to do. Sucking in a deep breath, she brought her finger to the spot behind her right ear and pressed to power down. Immediately she felt dizzy, disoriented, like something essential had drained out of her. It was the security of being online, the comfort of never getting lost, the knowledge that every thought and experience would be recorded to play again and again. But it was freeing, too. Nothing would be recorded, and nothing could be accessed either. At least, not the specific memories she'd programmed to recall immediately and in full. Memories that seemed to absorb her. With her cube down, the chatter of the crowd instantly shifted from her native collusion language to
to different dialects from across the solar system. She forgot that her translator had been connected to her cube, and now the foreign words, tongue clicks, whistles, and beeps, shattered the air around her. Her great ancestors had managed without cubes, and Rhi wondered how they could have possibly learned so many languages just by studying.
They're auctioning off droids, too. Decommissioned models, a boy ahead of her said. His Naui caught her ear, a local accent with a sing-song cadence.
Julian. He turned around even as she picked him out of the crowd. His blue eyes widened. They'd been the same height for as long as they'd known each other, until he shot up a couple of years ago. She had to look up into his eyes now, which annoyed her to no end. It was a competition she would never win.
Shh, she insisted just before he called out her name. You have to power down your cube, quickly, she added, when it seemed like he might argue.
You're being paranoid, he said. It was supposedly impossible to hack into someone's cube. But there were rumors that Siotra and his lackeys monitored the citizens this way, by invading their memories and observations through their cubes. And Rhi couldn't risk it. Besides, my mom told me if you do it too much, you'll go mad.
So they said. Most people went their whole lives without going offline. But there were entire communities, hundreds of thousands of people in the Outer Belt, that hadn't had native cubes installed. And what were a few minutes here and there offline? Rhi wouldn't say she liked the feeling, but she liked the discomfort of it. With every minute she managed to endure, she felt stronger.
Just do it, Rhi said.
Ugh, I hate the way it feels.
But Julian put his finger to his neck and made a face like he'd been pricked with a giant needle, and Rhi relaxed.
And what are you even doing here?
Well, Mata'an Sirili to you, too, she said, muttering the collusion greeting under her breath. Had she wanted him to be pleased? Rhi wasn't sure. She shoved her hand deep into her pocket and felt the cool telescope in her palm. It belonged to Julian. It always would. They'd known each other ever since Andres Siotra had banished her, or practically banished her, to Nau Fruma 9 years ago, when he became regent.
My flight's been delayed, she added. It wasn't exactly a lie, since the craft wouldn't leave without her.
He glanced behind him at the boys he'd been speaking to, then turned away from them again, nudging her farther into the crowd. There was a layer of dust on his skin and matting his dark blonde hair. Vairin, his father, was part Raetan. But Julian looked Naui through and through. His great-great-grandfather on his mother's side was one of the original settlers on Nau Fruma.
You know the Illidio is one of the safest crafts out there, he said, reaching for his cube out of habit. There's only a 2% malfunction rate, and there's never been any kind of accident that...
That's not why I left, she said, grabbing his hand so he wouldn't power up. She dropped it quickly. Ever since their last spar, it felt strange when they touched.
I'm not scared, if that's what you think.
Okay, he tilted his head and squinted, a thing she'd seen him do a million times before. Rhi stiffened at the way he sized her up, the way he seemed so certain he was right.
I just thought, because of what happened to your family.
Come on, she said, grabbing a handful of fabric at the edge of his sleeve. The Tassin are looking for me. Rhi led the way as they threaded through another row of vendors, glad that Julian couldn't see her face. She didn't want to talk about her family. Instead, she quickly described how she'd slipped away, evaded a Tassin, and ignored her Tai's call. She gripped Julian's shirt like it was a lifeline. He was her best friend. Her only friend, really. And he was the son of her trainer, Vairin, who taught them side by side the past 9 years. Julian didn't like being offline for even a moment. He had to know everything, always, and loved using his cube to pull up some memory in order to prove a point, or to prove Ree wrong. It was maddening. But now, she wondered if she'd miss it. It was getting darker. Hundreds of sparklers burned brightly. Night was falling quickly, and the sense of urgency felt big and real in Ree's chest. The sun was a massive burning star, leaving, just like she was. But she didn't know if she'd ever be back. Not after what she had planned. They passed a crowd that had formed around a small makeshift ring, watching as two scorpions circled each other in the center. More of the insects were trapped in glass jars, trying to crawl their way out. A skinny bookie with sharp elbows hollered the odds and took bets on the side.
"So, how much longer do you have?" Julian asked. "When does the craft launch?"
"An hour ago."
"Keep walking," she said over her shoulder by way of an answer. "Sooli," Julian said in a huff. "Are you going to be this bossy when you're empress?"
He was joking. She was always this bossy, whether they were competing in archery, stealing moon plums, or playing pranks on the staff who tended to read day and night. But that word, empress, was like a thick black smoke filling her lungs. An entire valley of collusion flowers would be cut down to decorate the capital city on her 16th birthday, the day of her coronation. In just 1 week's time, she'd come face to face with Siotra. Then, she'd finally have her revenge. She took a deep breath, stopped, and turned to him.
"Listen, I came to tell you I don't deserve this. I don't want this," she said instead.
Ree held up the telescope that Julian must have slipped in her bag before they said goodbye. She guessed it had cost months of his wages from working in the greenhouses. It was made of silver, a metal so rare that it could be mined only in the Outer Belt, and it came at a steep price.
"That was your birthday gift," Julian said softly. "You weren't supposed to find it till you were on your way."
Ree shook her head. He was hurt, she could tell, but it was too generous.
"You hate it," he said flatly.
"Don't be stupid," Ree said as she shoved the telescope into his hand. There was dirt from the greenhouse under his nails.
"I don't hate it."
As if anyone could hate something so beautiful. "It's just..." She didn't know how to explain it in a way he'd understand. In truth, she loved it. She'd loved everything he'd ever given her. Found things, mostly. A tiny sun-bleached skull of a bat, or a jagged crystal that reflected the light in a rainbow if she held it just so. Ree would be leaving those behind, too. It felt wrong to accept anything from him. It felt like, by taking something so special from Julian, she'd have to have a heart as pure as his. Julian slid the telescope open. Each compartment was smaller than the last, tapering toward the eyepiece. At full extension, it was the whole length of his arm. Just then, a kid tore past them, the sparkler in his hand illuminating Julian's face briefly in the darkness. From this angle, she could see the scar from where he'd split his chin open years ago, scaling the south wall of the palace to see her. He'd just returned from the old ruins, looking for moon snakes, and that night he'd brought the cast-offs of their milk-white skin to show her.
"Look up there,"
Julian pointed to the constellation of Terracott. Up in the sky, the maiden's hair unraveled into a spiral that ended with a tiny orange light. He handed her back the telescope.
"Don't lose that spot."
But Ree struggled to find the light when she brought it to her eye. There was only a blue-black sky in the viewfinder, and as she searched left and right, she grew anxious. She levered onto the balls of her feet, as if an extra 2 inches would bring her closer. Julian guided the telescope higher. She could feel his calloused palm cupping her hand. Her hood fell back as she tilted her head up, and she felt his breath on her neck. A memory surfaced without her calling for it. Surfacing organically, making her skin prickle. The moment just a week ago when he'd pinned her in the dojo. If she'd turned her head just a fraction of an inch. She gasped when Kalu came into sight. Swirls of orange and white cascaded across the planet's surface. It looked just like the birthday suite Julian's mom had made Rhi when she turned 12. Whipped cream smeared on a warm piece of tenkang. Simple and delicate, and almost too beautiful to eat. She'd loved it more than the elaborate cake imported from Kalu.
Oh, holy ancestors! That is awesome!
You know the atmosphere on Kalu is so thick that they don't get yellows in their sunsets?
I didn't know that, she said absently, still looking up at the brilliant planet.
She remembered the sky and sunrise and sunset, though, especially her last dawn on Kalu. Blues and purples peeking over the horizon and scattering across the sky. The moment she learned of her family's deaths, she'd fumbled through all the memories on her cube, searching to recall their last moment together, only to wish she hadn't. Her mother's hair, gray and frizzy, the dark circles under her father's eyes, her sister purposefully ignoring her. All of them angry, disappointed, colder looking in recall somehow than they had seemed in the flesh. As if they'd already been dead for years. No one told you that about the way recall worked. How easily you could ruin the things you loved. Rhi chose to rely on her organic memory to remember only the good moments. Joss sneaking dried Mira candies to her in bed when she was sick. Insisting the tailor make them both a set of pants like their father's. And flinging aside her parasol to cartwheel in the sun. Over and over in the buckwheat fields outside the palace. Her father, a tall man, lifting Rhi easily onto his shoulders for a daily walk along the palace perimeter. And her mother, undoing Rhi's tight braids every evening. Something a servant could have easily done. And rubbing her aching head with lavandula oil.
Be a good girl, was the last thing she'd said to Rhi.
And Rhi remembered nodding, as if she'd been saying, I will. But she'd lied. Their father had given the sisters special coins once, souvenirs from a trip he'd taken in the Bezoral Quadrant, one for Joss and one for her. When her father ushered her family on the craft the night of the accident, Joss and Rhi had been fighting about whose turn it was to press the thruster deploy.
Stars, you're stupid! Soil, you're still stupid, Joss had told Rhi,
flipping her coin to show Rhi it didn't matter which side landed first. Rhi had been 6 years old, and furious. She'd snuck off while her parents were distracted. She'd wanted to go get her own coin and prove Joss was even stupider. Acting like a baby, just like Joss always said. She'd been gravity-bound when the craft launched. When it tore off into the atmosphere and disappeared. She hadn't known, of course, that it would never return, that exactly 4 minutes after takeoff, it would burn up in the outer rings of Rylier and crash, killing everyone on board instantly. All because her father had wanted peace. In signing the Ernu Treaty that ended the Great War between the planets, he'd signed his own life away. Siotra had warned him. Half the beings in the galaxy will want you dead, he'd practically snarled, his hands clutching onto the collar of her father's shirt. Your own people will make you pay. Rhi had burst in at that moment, interrupting their standoff. No one had ever spoken to her father that way, or handled him so roughly. Rhi clenched her fists as she remembered the threat laced in the Crown Regent's words. The menace she felt when she went through her cube playback, searching for all the memories she had of her father just before he died.
Your own people will make you pay.
As in, Siotra would make him pay. He'd made her father believe that he had to take their family and flee from some imminent danger on Kalu. But the only danger was Siotra himself. Once her family boarded the ship, isolated from all of their friends and allies out of a need for secrecy, it would have been easy enough for Siotra to orchestrate the explosion that ended their lives. He'd had connections from the war, and there was no doubt in Rhi's mind he'd killed plenty of men before he'd killed her family that day. She'd never shared the memory with anyone. No one would have believed a child. And now that she was grown, mere hours from becoming Empress, there was no need to tell anyone, ever. She'd have her revenge on her own terms.
Just take it, Julian said now, motioning to the telescope in her hand. Pretend it isn't a birthday gift. Let's say I'm just letting you borrow it till I see you next.
Till I see you next, she repeated in her head. By then, everything would be different. She'd learned that there was no guarantee of anything, or anyone, ever. Streaks of orange and red cut across the black sky, shining, burning, bubbling. Edges chipped away as the meteors moved at impossible speeds. Cheers erupted all around them as everyone burst into applause. Rhi couldn't record it. She'd just have to remember how she felt at this moment, looking up into the void, every joy and fear inside her boiling, as if she were the same temperature as the supercharged rocks hurtling across the sky. With each flare, the question she'd asked herself for years burned brighter and brighter inside of her. Why her? Why did she survive? Do you think I'm good? She asked him suddenly. There was a prickling sensation in her throat.
Rhiannon,
he trailed off. After all these years, she wasn't sure if she'd ever heard him say her whole name. And she didn't like it. Didn't like the formality of it, the way it made her feel as though she'd already floated far away from him, and from this life. But wasn't that what she wanted? Wasn't that better for everyone? He seemed as if he was going to say something serious, but finally he shook his head and took her hand.
No, I think you're weird.
They'd held hands a million times before, to help each other over the crest of the sand dunes, or to pull the other up off the dojo mat. But now, he laced his fingers through hers and squeezed. She held her breath. Wondering if she should squeeze back. If it even meant anything. If she was overthinking it completely. The crowd to the left began to murmur. People parted like water cleaved by the prow of a boat, revealing a tall, white-haired man. He was too old to be a Tassin. He had a slightly uneven gait and a funny rhythm to his walk, as if one leg was longer than the other. Vayrin. She and Julian wrenched their hands apart. His expression was illuminated in the light of a nearby torch, sad, knowing, stern. He barely looked at his son. Instead, Vayrin touched the back of his neck and spoke something into his cube. She could read his mouth. I found her. With every step Rhiannon took, the long, white corridor of the Elidio seemed to narrow, as if the royal ship were slowly closing in on her. It was done. They'd left now Fruma, and it would be years before she'd see Julian again. There was no sadness to draw from, only a static numbness. She'd opted to keep her cube off. She didn't want to remember any of this. Reeve focused on Vayrin's coat, which trailed behind him like a flag at half-mast. Because she was meant to be Empress, the rules of decorum stated that no one should walk in front of her. Yet Varen did, evidently still angry with her for running off. She could tell Ty Rihanna was irritated by this transgression. She made a point of standing behind Rhee, though they'd often walked side by side.
"There are a variety of festivities planned upon your arrival," Ty Rihanna said, delivering the words in the breathy, high-society accent she'd urged Rhee to adopt. She walked slowly and deliberately, just as she did everything, and Rhee could hear the many fine layers of her formal silk robes swishing as she moved.
"How exciting," Rhee responded.
She hadn't meant it to sound so sarcastic. Her footfalls were heavy, and though she knew it was the craft's artificial gravity, there was a heavy feeling in her chest, too, as if her heart were pumping liquid metal to every part of her body. Her hair had been re-braided so tightly that her head ached. She looked down at her hands. Her palms still tingled where Julian had touched her.
"It is," Ty Rihanna agreed,
and Rhee could hear the chastisement in her voice. She was native Kalusian, like Rhee, and they shared the same broad cheekbones and tan skin.
"Our Empress coming home at last. Have you seen the Hollows today?"
When Rhee shook her head, the Tie took a handheld device and projected a three-dimensional image into the air as they walked. A countdown to the coronation logo appeared, the swirly script curling around an image of Rhee taken last year, digitally enhanced to bring out the green specks in her one hazel eye. She wasn't smiling in the image, which Kalusian focus groups reported made her look older and more determined. There'd been a big media push as of late to convince the public that a teenage girl could rule the galaxy.
"We're less than 12 hours away from making history when Princess Rhiannon Ta'an will take the blood oath and swear her fealty to the people of Kalu," Nero Simna announced.
Appearing as a hollow that seemingly walked alongside Rhee in the corridor, the countdown host wore a black, short-sleeved shirt with a high, rounded collar, as was custom in diplomacy positions. As ambassador to the office of the regent, he'd interviewed Rhee several times in the past few months, asking her a series of frivolous questions about her upcoming coronation. He'd smiled in a way that showed off his perfectly square jaw and made Rhee flush. He had that effect on millions of viewers.
"Last-minute preparations are still underway," Nero continued.
Rhee had seen in the studio how the cameras filmed him from every angle, the holofeed adjusted to suit and integrate the viewer best. The footage cut to a live feed of Lenius Valley on Kalu, just outside the capital. The sloping hills of the valley, green and lush, created a natural amphitheater where the coronation ceremony would take place. Rhee would be front and center as she went through the ritual of slicing open her palm to symbolically spill her blood for Kalu. A crowd of thousands had already collected and would wait there through the night. Flower arrangements were still arriving, and a small army of people seemed to be moving things back and forth for no apparent reason other than to fuss. The whole event looked extravagant, cloyingly beautiful, and like yet another careful orchestration from Siotra.
"We'll see it in person soon enough," Rhee said, gently lowering Ty Rayana's hand.
Her tie turned off the feed so that the hologram zipped closed and disappeared.
"I'm eager to speak with Regent Siotra. Will he be available when we arrive?"
His name in Rhee's mouth tasted bitter, acidic, but she needed to keep track of his every move.
"Of course," Ty Rayana raised her eyebrow, giving Rhee a questioning look. "He's been preparing for your arrival for months."
"And I've been preparing for years," Rhee almost said.
Varen didn't even acknowledge their conversation. Tonight he seemed even quieter than usual, and she felt that familiar shame she'd often felt from her trainer, that she'd somehow disappointed him.
"We'll need to discuss the logistics of your arrival,"
Ty Rihanna continued as they reached a fork in the corridor. Shall we head to the bridge? The captain is ready to meet with us.
Rhee stood between two paths, her mind racing with intended excuses to avoid whatever Ty had planned. She'd have to pass the entire onboard staff en route, who were no doubt furious with her for running off earlier.
Perhaps the girl needs to rest first, Vayron said, his back still to them.
I'd like that. Vayron could escort me to my chambers, Rhee said quickly.
He was not a man of many words, but he was perceptive. He'd given her an out.
It's been a long day.
Other than a slight thinning of her lips, Ty Rihanna concealed her displeasure well. Rhee knew she'd never admit how distasteful she found it that Vayron was half Raetan. There were old wounds from the Great War that Rhee feared would never be healed.
Yes, it has been a long day, hasn't it?
Ty Rihanna said after a moment passed. There was blame threaded into her tone. It had been a long day because Rhee had delayed their flight.
We'll be sure to reconvene after you've gotten some rest.
The closer they got to the coronation, the more Rhee had dared to defy her tie, though it didn't change the mixture of terror and respect she had for the woman. She bowed her head before Ty Rihanna could change her mind, essentially dismissing her. The ceremonial Kalu headdress that sat upon Rhee's head shifted slightly, and she had to steady it with her hand. It had a colorful plume that gathered at the top of her head. She'd been forced to wear it, just like she'd been forced to change into a red dress embroidered with gold thread. The grit had been scrubbed from her tan arms, which now prickled with goosebumps. Vayron and Rhee continued on after Ty Rihanna excused herself. It felt strange to be walking in silence, especially after the long procession of Tossin and security sweeps. Whenever Rhee had complained about the escort, since the time she was a child, Ty Rihanna always replied with the same answer.
They're for your protection.
And Rhee had always bit back the same answer.
All the security in the galaxy didn't protect my family.
At the end of the corridor, Vayron tapped a code into a silver keypad. Just as Rhee caught up to him, the door slid up with a quiet hiss and opened to a large room with floor-to-ceiling windows. Her ancestors were projected via hollow onto the only solid wall in the room. Clustered along a small ledge were offerings, grain, fruit, Mira candies. Not her quarters, but a room of worship. She nodded to Vayron in respect and thanks. He'd been raised on Raeta. Honoring the ancestors was not part of his religion, but he knew that the practice always calmed her. Rhee walked toward the windows, bowing before every ancestor and lighting incense as she passed, until she reached the portraits of her own family. Her father, her mother, and Joss. If their bodies had been discovered, their cubes intact, she might have been willed certain memories they'd put aside. But even those had disappeared the day they died. Through the glass, Camriel fire rained against the darkness of space. In the distance, Rhee saw a pulsing orange light. Kalu no longer seemed like a fixed point in the enormous sky, but a future she knew would be hers. Another chill ran over her arms. She'd be meeting with various dignitaries, and she'd been prepped by Ty Rihanna in the customs of every planet, until she could curtsy, bow, and sign in her sleep. But there was still much to learn. She touched her neck instinctively to recall the well-worn memory of a family breakfast, startled to forget she'd powered off. On the cube, her memories weren't arranged chronologically, but by how often she'd revisited them. And this particular memory was always stacked at the top of her queue. But now, without her cube, Rhee had to search for this memory, closing her eyes and climbing down her memories as if feeling along the roots of a tree. Her father, at the head of the long table, teaching, always.
As Empress, you must be fair,
but decisive, he'd said, smearing his toast with one stroke of butter, as if to demonstrate his point. He'd been talking to Jocelyn, of course. Her older sister had known all her life that she would rule. Funny. Without the cube, parts of the memory receded into the background, while others rose to the surface. How Jocelyn had fed a piece of meat to their hounds under the table, winking at Rhi as if they were in on a secret. While on her cube, she had never replayed the memory that far. She opened her eyes just as a particularly dazzling display of flares burst across the sky. Orange marks clawed against the darkness and faded just as quickly. The silence made it feel like a sacred act. Or an omen. She looked over at her trainer, who threaded his fingers behind his back. He faced the window, shoulders squared and chest out, like the soldier he was. He'd barely said anything since they boarded. "Are you angry with me?" she asked him.
"No," Varen said, though he wouldn't meet her eye. "But they do things differently in the capital. Running away from your duties would not have been tolerated there."
"They'll think whatever they please." Her habit of wearing pants, her martial arts training, it would all strike them as odd. But Rhi feared something worse than popular opinion. She feared that after all this time, all this preparation, she would freeze when the time came to avenge her family and kill Syotra. But she could not allow Syotra to live. He'd masqueraded as her father's friend. But it was Syotra who'd arranged for their departure and seen them off that very night. How many times has she replayed the memory of the fight she'd interrupted?
"Half the beings in the galaxy will want you dead."
Syotra's bared teeth, the certainty, the hatred in his voice. Surely this was why her father had gathered them in the darkness of night. Syotra made the Emperor believe they had to flee for their lives, and then he destroyed their craft.
"The Crown Princess has always been so obstinate," Varen said now.
"Crown Princess," she scowled at her trainer. "You know I don't go by that title." It was Joss's claim. She'd been next in line to inherit the throne, and only because of her death would Rhi be Empress.
"I do,"
he nodded again as he gazed back at the door behind them. The lights of the flares made red slashes across the side of his face.
"But as we grow older, we must also accept the people we've become."
"What do you mean?" Something in his tone made prickles of anxiety spiderwalk up her back. Varen turned, and she saw for the first time the look on his face. He had dark skin from his Raten side, and blue eyes common in second-wave collusions, an unusual pairing, and evidence of his mixed heritage. It was strange to see him upset. He was always so good at concealing his true feelings. At that moment, his resemblance to Julian was striking.
"I'm sorry, Rhi. I hope the gods forgive me."
"Sorry for..." Before she could say what, Varen grabbed her throat and pushed her hard against the window. Her headdress fell from the force of the impact, and Varen stepped on it, crushing the feathers under the tread of his boot. From his thumb to his index finger, the length of his hand fit cleanly around Rhi's neck. He lifted her off the ground and squeezed. She felt her windpipe closing. She gasped for air as she tried to claw his fingers off one by one. It was impossible. His familiar face, the face of her best friend's father, of the trainer she'd known for years, seemed to warp before her eyes. Everything was slowing. Her tongue felt thick and dry, and she fought for breath. White bursts of light softened the corners of her vision. The ancestors peered at her from their portraits, hollows frozen in time, waiting to see how it ended. Would she join them?
"I'm sorry, Rhi," he repeated,
even as Varen brought his other hand up to her throat. Tears were welling in his eyes.
They gave me no choice. I had no choice.
Chapter 2. Alyosha. The ship cut a hard left. Alyosha slammed against the boiler. The metal hull groaned and flexed. Tools flew off his belt and floated away. They landed just out of reach. His cue buzzed faintly on his neck. He tapped to answer.
"What's your status?" Vincent asked. "I lost my favorite wrench," Allie said, squatting down to see where it had fallen.
"And the grav beam?"
"I'm 10 minutes out from fixing it."
If he could find his socket wrench.
"Work your magic and shave off some time, yeah? Just tried hailing this crazy-looking ship in a routine stop, but now the pilot is acting feisty."
Vincent sent a view of his dash, which played on the back of Allie's eyelids, so that it briefly doubled his vision. The ship in question was shaped like a beetle. Too small to be a cargo ship, too big to be a standard civilian pod. And about 30 clicks northeast. It wasn't slowing down, even as they pursued it. The Uniforce had a term for ships like this. Non-compliant. They'd need the grav beam up and running to lock on to the target and reel it in. Annoying for Allie. Fantastic for ratings.
7 minutes out, Vincent said.
I'd work faster if I wasn't trying to hang on for my life, Allie told him, blinking out the image.
Where'd you learn to fly?
Your mom's bedroom. She taught me this move. The revolutionary barrel rolled, and Allie scrambled for a handhold while the world somersaulted around him. What a showboat.
If I throw up in the reactor, it'll be your fault.
But we'll all be dead, so who'll blame me?
A freaking philosopher, this one. For the past 16 months, they'd been aboard the Revolutionary together. A 2-man sweeper staffed with a droid named Pavel that Allie had programmed himself. Pavel was a fan favorite. More famous than either Allie or Vin, which was saying something, because they were pretty popular. After all, they were the 2 stars of the Revolutionary Boys. Neither Allie nor Vin had set out to be famous. Far from it. As members of the Uniforce, Kalu's military, their assignment had originally been seen as a punishment for 2 slackers who'd barely survived basic. They'd been banished to the perimeter of the Outer Belt, policing renegade poachers and investigating claims of stolen or illegally modified ships when someone put a bulletin out, that sort of thing. When the producers had decided to bring the cameras on board for a short, feel-good, pro-Uniforce documentary, no one had expected the show to blow up. Well, almost no one. Jethazar, the charm kid they'd come up with in basic, had called it from about 1 million miles away. Whenever Allie pulled up the memory of Jeth on his cube, Jeth would shake his head and exhale a plume of smoke through the gills on either side of his neck.
"Y'all don't forget me when you're famous and stuff,"
he'd said in that charm twang. In a way that was so solemn, Allie hadn't known if he'd been serious or just had a really solid deadpan going on. Now, The Revolutionary Boys was the most popular show on Drone Vision. The cameras had stayed, and the whole thing became a production. They were on their 2nd season, and Allie couldn't scratch his butt without a camera beaming it to the worlds at all hours of the day. The single glorious exception was the hour in the morning when the 2 collusion moons, now Fruma and Resto, crossed orbits. Then, the Drone Vision network was completely disabled, and there was no way any satellite signals could come in or out. It wasn't exactly the life of a soldier. It was better. Sure, maybe Allie wasn't a natural in front of the camera. Not like Vincent, who was game to smile for the daisies whenever and wherever. Those little cameras brought out the best in him. The one-liners, the perfectly timed expressions, the mouthful of perfectly white teeth. But it was sure as hell better than being stuck in some Ray town coughing up dust. Plus, there were benefits to the Revolutionary Boys' attention. Like the girls. rubbing elbows with celebrities, rubbing something, Vin had joked, at the occasional fundraiser. All the fan messages that made him feel like he mattered. Of course, there were bad things, too. There'd been a few signs at the last season premiere party, on all the fan holo forums, pasted over the show's advertisements. Go home, Dusties. It didn't matter that Allie was always on his best behavior. He wanted to rep his planet right. But to a certain kind of person, he'd always be the enemy. A lot of folks couldn't get over the memories they had of the Raetan uprisings, and the way Raeta had sided with Fontis against Kalu during the Great War. That was why Allie had originally lied about having Raetan blood. He'd heard stories about how Raetans were treated in the Uniforce, since there was still bad blood in the whole refugee situation. So he'd checked a different box and told a little white lie. No one would have known if it weren't for the show, which sent a bunch of journalists digging into his past. At least the show had Allie's back, so long as the ratings were good. When it was finally revealed that Allie had Raetan blood, the producers ignored the protesters, the loud contingent of collusions who ran around calling Raetans animals and savages, or worse, Dusties. The revolutionary angled left again, then cursed into his cube. Allie! Target is taking evasive measures. Hurry up on the grav beam already. I'll finish what I started. Don't worry about me. You focus on flying and try not to get us killed. Deal. You have 6 minutes now. Out. It was probably the longest conversation they'd ever had over their cubes. Vin never kept his cube on when he didn't have to. His parents were funny like that. Vin was forced to meditate and use visualizations and mnemonics, which kind of cracked Allie up, since a whole chunk of the universe had to do all that anyway. No fancy names required. It was just called being born poor. Only certain governments could afford to subsidize cube installations for their citizens. Allie wasn't a native cube user, and he'd gotten his installed pretty late in the game. He knew there were all kinds of folks in the wider galaxy addicted to their memories. There were public campaigns to stay healthy and in the moment, which mostly meant not to waste away like those sad sacks who kept on revisiting their glory days when they had a full head of hair and a girl on their arm. Allie didn't get that. Why you'd want to live inside the past. He liked recording his new life. Maybe eventually he'd accumulate enough good memories to crowd out the bad ones, so that they'd never showed up again in his feed. A drone vision camera zoomed into his line of vision, and Allie swatted it away. "At least do something useful if you're going to get up in my face," he told the Daisy. That's what they called the drone vision cameras. A linguistic evolution that started with the casual term, "day sees," based on the camera's ability to provide bright lighting, and quickly became daisies, even though they looked more like giant spiders than any flower he'd ever seen, on any planet. Light. A light from its underside flicked on, illuminating the small room. The daisy was compact, the size of his palm, and it fluttered up to the low ceiling. Allie got on his hands and knees, staying close to the ground as the ship veered wildly from left to right. What the hell was going on up there? Finally, he spotted the wrench in the far dark corner, wedged in the middle of a network of pipes and wires. 2 years ago, he could have crawled over to it easily enough, but at 17, he was just shy of 20 hands tall and still going. His growth spurt had come late and with a vengeance. Even his bones hurt, like he'd been strapped to an old-school torture device and stretched every which way. He wondered now how much taller than his dad he was. He knew for damn sure he was too big to fit through anything constructed by a collusion. They had leaner builds, and everything they made was like 25% too small for Allie to ever use comfortably. But their engineering was top-notch. His arms were long, too, which meant that,
One, he could take Vin down in a slapboxing match. And two, he could just brush the metal wrench with the tips of his fingers. He eased it into his palm, sprang up, and went to work on the grav beam core. Ratcheting, tightening, realigning. His hands moved carefully. The trick was to focus on all the things he could control. Vin's insane flying, the rusty ship 2 seconds away from falling apart, the cameras that crept up on him everywhere he went. All of that fell squarely into the realm of the things he couldn't control. The revolutionary jerked left again. Steadying himself, Ali planted his feet and worked quickly, ignoring the daisy that lowered to get a good look at his face. It was always waiting to zoom in on thoughtful moments that the producers could use as B-roll and insert anywhere. Ali almost swatted it away again, but he caught his reflection in the lens, and the nick in his eyebrow that girls were always asking about on the Hall of Forums. Even into the second season, he was still not used to the fame. He'd been the kind of kid who studied physics diagrams for hours, not the guy pulling pretty girls. It didn't help that Ali was so dark, but now, for some reason, folks seemed to think he looked all right, describing his skin like it was cape or chocolate or an expensive type of wood. If he was being honest, it annoyed Ali. You never heard collusions compared to food, but it was better than catching tahis about it. He reached for the daisy. "Sorry, little guy, I need to borrow something," he said. It tried to flutter out of his grasp, but his reach was long, and he snatched it up effortlessly. "Easy, easy." He unscrewed its lens while the mini propellers still spun. When he got the lens free, the daisy shot up and fled toward the doorway. Ali jammed the lens into the core, adjusted the angle, and powered it on. There was a high-pitched whirl as the grav beam charged up. The sweetest sound, like a chorus of loyal subjects chanting his name. "I am the god of grav beams," he called into his cube. "Great. Now come be the god of co-pilots and help me lock down this chartois of a target." "On it." Ali ducked through the short doorway and scrambled up the access ladder. Across the catwalk and down the corridor, he ran toward the bridge as fast as he could in 0.3 gravity. He'd never gotten used to the buoyancy. He'd been shuffled between refugee camps from one Ray town to the next. His past was mostly a blurry series of evacuations. And even though he'd never had a home to call his own, he'd always had gravity. But up here, he half ran, half swam. At the next corner, Ali grabbed a makeshift handhold, swinging around the turn and launching himself forward. He'd set up dozens of shortcuts in the same way, broken poles and useless metal components all soldered to the inner hull. He and Vin scaled them like monkey bars. The door to the bridge slid open, and there was Vincent, standing over the ship's console as he bore down on the throttle. He flew the revolutionary like he was playing a video game, which was to say, recklessly. But he was a good pilot. A dozen cameras hovered around him in a semicircle, positioned at different angles and distances. He was a second-wave collusion, and looked it, with light eyes and fair skin that turned golden when he tanned. "Just in time," he called over his shoulder. "I've never seen this model. It's unscannable, but the navigation equipment must be top-notch. I've lost it twice already." Half the daisies turned in Ali's direction, like a flock of ugly birds. He took his seat at the helm. "What do you mean, unscannable?" "I can't get a read on it." Vin tapped the screen on his console. "It's invisible on all the nav equipment." Ali touched his finger to his cube and magnified his vision. "It almost looks like it's made of wood?" It wasn't impossible. Modified organic material could be used for all kinds of things in deep space, but not a lot of people had the tech. The Uniforce definitely didn't. "It's kind of weird."
weird,
Vin agreed, with an edge in his voice. Did it respond to your hail?
Yeah, with some sort of code. I got your boy working on it now.
Vin gestured to Pavel,